This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Conditions in America's black urban slums are so bad that a lot of people have just given up on them. And as my guest Nicholas Lemon says, there seems to be a conviction that we don't know what could possibly help the ghettos, and that even if we did know, it couldn't be done for lack of political support. Lemon doesn't share that crippling pessimism. For the past decade, he's been writing about the urban poor for The Atlantic magazine. His new book synthesizes those years of research. It's called The Promised Land, and it's about how America was changed by the great black migration from the South to the North. The migration spanned the early 40s to the late 60s. The Great Migration began when sharecroppers started moving north because they were displaced by mechanized cotton picking. Chicago became a center for migrating blacks, and Lemon says politicians like Mayor Daley did everything they could to keep the new black population away from the whites.
Everybody today thinks that race riots only started to happen in the 1960s and were a within-the-ghetto phenomenon. In Chicago, and really many other northern cities such as Detroit and New York, there were race riots throughout the 1940s and 1950s. And what usually caused them was a black family trying to move into a white neighborhood or some form of residential integration. That would be followed by a mob gathering, throwing firebombs and rocks, police numbering as many as in the thousands called out to quell a riot that lasted for several days out of control. This was sort of the backdrop to the way that black migration was greeted in Chicago. So it was extremely important, really Mayor Daley's top priority, and it was a sort of a fool's errand because he just wasn't ever able to do it, was to draw a line somewhere and maintain residential segregation. That way, the machine that he controlled would work most efficiently, and the whole city would seem to him to be under control. In other words, there was a black political boss named Bill Dawson who was loyal to Daley and who controlled the black wards. And then there were a whole series of white political bosses also loyal to Daley who controlled the white wards. Daley's dream was to keep things that way so that even while thousands and thousands of black Southerners were streaming into Chicago, he would be able to keep those neighborhood lines and keep there being a well-defined black neighborhood on the South Side and a well-defined white neighborhood everywhere else. That was really his goal. And finally, the numbers of migrants got so great that he began to build new housing in the black neighborhoods in the form of public housing. This is, anybody who's been to Chicago knows the big high-rise projects, most famously the Robert Taylor homes that are in the South Side ghetto. And Daley built tens of thousands of units of high-rise public housing in the ghettos during the late 50s and early 60s in an effort to keep the black migration contained within the traditional black ghetto.
So the idea was never to improve the lives of the black people who needed new housing or to integrate them into society. It was to keep them in poor black neighborhoods.
Yes, although I think that Daley's primary goal was residential segregation, I think. I think that he thought of this as much more benign than we would think of it as being today. He thought that the machine would take care of these people, and he didn't see that high-rise public housing would turn out to be as much of a disaster as mm-hmm. it has. So I think that he thought that he was doing something, and in fact that he was doing more than most big city mayors to make the migration work. He just didn't have any concept of the magnitude of what he was dealing with, both in terms of the number of people coming in, the special difficulty of race as an issue in Chicago and in American life. He didn't. It was sort of the only time in Mayor Daley's career that he just didn't think big enough. He thought he was dealing with a fairly traditional ethnic migration to the city, in which people would live in an ethnic enclave for a generation and then slowly move into the middle class. And to the extent that it was much more complicated and big and bitter than that, he just threw up his hands. He didn't know what to do. And he became, you know, very bitter about it at the end.
Do you think that rural blacks from the South were considered more threatening to northern whites than blacks who were in the North were considered to be?
I think that the key thing there, somewhat, but I think that especially at the time, white people were not very much aware of the gradations and distinctions within black America.
Mm-hmm.
I think blacks were much more aware of that than whites were. I think to whites, it was just mainly the sheer numbers involved that was most threatening. In other words, in Chicago, in all the big cities, before World War I, which was when the first substantial migration took place, there was very little move to have strict residential segregation. And the reason is that blacks were just a very small ethnic group. If you read How the Other Half Lives by Jacob Riis, written 100 years ago about New York City, he describes blacks in New York as kind of a very minor group that didn't, you know, to him, the people who really posed a threat were the Jews and the Italians, who were really coming in big numbers, as opposed to a small, contained community of blacks. So the pattern that you start to see is race riots and very strict residential segregation and, to some extent, rigid job discrimination when the numbers start getting big. It's the size of the migration that leads to the white reaction, as opposed to who the migrants are exactly.
In your book, you write about Johnson's war on poverty, about various federal programs that were designed to improve conditions in America's slums. A lot of people have given up on federal programs and have accused it as, you know, throwing money at problems. You have not given up on that. In fact, you say that the federal government is best equipped to deal with the problem. How so?
Well, first of all, there's a tremendous amount of mythology about what actually went on, what the government actually did with respect to the ghettos. The government spent much less money on this problem than people think, had fewer programs than people think, generally devoted less effort than people think. Also, these programs, and I'm talking particularly about the war on poverty, just did not make poverty worse, I believe. I think that's a seductive myth that America has fallen for. I think the national government is best equipped to deal with these problems because I think that the lesson is clear that in American history, any progress on racial issues is always a national effort. It's always tied to a spirit of sort of national unification. This would be true of everything from emancipation to civil rights. For some reason, the reason being probably the strength of racial prejudice, localities tend not to make tremendous progress on the whole on race relations. And when breakthroughs are made, they tend to be made at the national level. And I think that the next breakthrough that needs to be made, which would be some kind of wholesale improvement in the terrible conditions in the ghettos, would also have to be made through the federal government as a vehicle.
Do you have programs in mind that you think would be effective?
Yes, I do. I think that the general idea is to concentrate very heavily on health, education, and job training, and also possibly job creation. In other words, what you would call very generally social programs, I think, or intervention programs would be another term. The most famous and popular of these programs is Head Start. Another widely acknowledged success story under this category is WIC, the pregnant women's and infants nutrition program. Basically, I think a very aggressive effort to intervene in the lives of people in the ghettos, particularly children, to ensure that they're healthy, well-educated, and trained for a job is essential, and is really the best shot. I'd cite as another example of somebody who's made a lot of progress doing this kind of thing, James Comer, a professor at Yale who has achieved dramatic results through intervention programs in New Haven elementary schools in the ghetto there. I think these programs would have an effect on the people who are in them, and also they would create a lot of employment opportunities to actually run the programs and administer them. And that, too, would have a very good effect. And indeed, that was one of the best effects of the war on poverty, was tremendously expanding the black middle class by making a lot of social service jobs available that hadn't been before.
I think the premise that you're working under is that the best thing federal programs can do is to help improve the lives of the people who live in slums, as opposed to changing the buildings, you know,
exactly,
as opposed to trying to, like, physically change the neighborhood.
Right. And there's the persistent dream is that the inner-city black slums can be revived, turned around, and turned into sort of thriving ethnic enclaves with an independent economic base. This idea is incredibly appealing to a wide range of people across the economic spectrum, ranging from the left to the right, all for slightly different reasons. But I just don't think that has really happened. The track record is, as I said before, tremendous out-migration from the poor inner-city slums to the point that now they're in really bad shape and have no economic base and very little social base. So I think that the idea that you're going to now have people moving back into these neighborhoods and many independent businesses starting is just as appealing as it may sound. It just isn't going to happen, and so that's why I do emphasize thinking about people rather than thinking about places.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Nicholas Lemon, and he is a national correspondent for The Atlantic Magazine and author of the new book, The Promised Land, How the Great Black Migration Changed America. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Nicholas Lemon is my guest. I'd like to hear what you think of food stamps and welfare. You know, a popular argument against programs like that now is, A, a lot of people cheat, and B, it's a disincentive to get work and economic independence.
Mm-hmm. Well, notice that in what I've called for does not come under the category of welfare or just improving people's material income, in part because I don't think that has much effect in helping people to get out, and in part because anything involving welfare is just so incredibly unpopular politically,
mm-hmm.
that I think that these kinds of social programs I'm talking about have much more chance of political survivability. I was just talking yesterday to a friend of mine who works for Illinois Bell in Chicago, who was saying that they put on a 15-cent a month charge onto phone bills to help give poor people phone service. And he said, we've got a firestorm on our hands here. People are so angry about paying 15 cents a month because they think it's for people on welfare.
Really?
There's just a kind of hatred of welfare out there. I think it's obviously true. It's a truism that if you get the level of guaranteed income support to a certain height, you'll create a disincentive to work. But remember that the level of AFDC benefits, that is welfare benefits, adjusted for inflation, peaked in around 1970. At that time, there was a famous welfare crisis, and people were streaming onto the rolls and so on. But really, since then, the benefit levels have drifted downward, or just by failing to rise with inflation. There hasn't been a steady increase in the rolls. And the best way to think of welfare is, rather than being a sort of enticement that is getting people to leave the workforce and go on to the welfare rolls. It provides a kind of economic base for people who, for whatever reason, don't participate in the economy. You have to have some kind of program like that. There just isn't any alternative to it. I don't think that at this point in our history we have to worry that welfare is becoming much more attractive and is luring people into a life of sloth. But on the other hand, in thinking about how to solve all these problems, I would not stress welfare. And I do believe that there should be as much linkage as possible between the welfare system and work, including such things as job training and government job programs for welfare recipients.
What are your expectations for President Bush? Do you think he will make any moves in the direction that you're suggesting? And if you would like to grade his performance so far on dealing with the problems of America's poor, I'd be interested in hearing it.
Well, I would say he basically hasn't done very much at all on the problems of America's poor. It's hard to say. If you listen to his speech last night, it seemed to me, perhaps engaging in wishful thinking, that he was indicating that he wants to do something about inner-city ghettos. Now, whether he will or not, I don't know. Comparing him to Reagan, President Reagan is somebody who really, in many ways, built a career around opposition to the war on poverty. His whole political career of the past quarter century really coincides with the birth of the war on poverty, and he's been attacking it all the way, most recently in his autobiography, which was published last year. And in there, there's a remarkable passage where he says, he describes deciding to seek the presidency, and he was at his ranch riding his horse, and what was going through his mind at that moment was a he decided, I have to run for president because this war on poverty is so terrible, it's making more people poor. I don't think that President Bush has that kind of attitude. I think that I'm just guessing now that his real attitude would be something on the borderline of the poor are always with us. If you look at his career, it's a career not of active opposition to civil rights and anti-poverty programs, and not of active championing of them either, of just uninvolvement with them. I just don't think he's kind of intellectually engaged in these issues. But I think that on the other hand, you know, and if I had to guess, I would guess he won't do a whole lot. But on the other hand, I say he won't do a whole lot because when you saw how he put together the coalition in the Gulf War, you thought this is someone who is acting on some kind of, he's touched on a wellspring of passion. There's something that the business of putting this coalition together, something about that really touches a deep chord in Bush. And I don't think social policy has the same deep-seated effect on him. It doesn't stir his soul in the way that it did Lyndon Johnson's or Robert Kennedy's. But I do think that he now looks at the world this way. He thinks, my re-election is virtually assured. I never have to run for office again. And after 2 years in office, it's to put it as he would, it's posterity city from here on in for the next 6 years. And he has to be thinking, and obviously from the speech last night is thinking, that if he could go down in history as the man who healed the ghettos, it would be a tremendous mark in his favor historically. So I think he would like to be that, but that's sort of a desired end result, and how to get there, I think, is something that he has a much hazier idea about.
It seems to me one of the impressions you'd like to leave us with is that a sense of hopelessness about really dealing with American poverty is really unproductive, and that you really have to feel like there are solutions, there are things that can be done, people can be helped, and you do what you can.
Right, exactly. I think that hopelessness is completely misplaced. First of all, hopelessness about virtually any problem is misplaced. If you study American history, it's filled with problems that supposedly couldn't be solved. And lo and behold, most of them tend to be solved. Often, they tend to be solved by the people themselves because the government doesn't respond. But they do tend to be solved. It's really silly and ahistorical to think of problems as being completely insoluble and hopeless.
I'm just interested in hearing a little bit about what it's been like for you to write about the urban poor for a decade. And I'm not sure exactly what I want to hear. But I don't know. It seems to me you've seen things get worse, not better.
I wouldn't say necessarily that I've seen things get worse, not better. Things were pretty bad when I started out working on this beat, and I don't think that things have gotten dramatically worse. The biggest change, as I said, has been continuous trickle of people out of the ghettos. And you can only assume that that's good news in the sense that the people who are leaving are finding something better. I would say that I've found that this whole world, the better you get to know it, the less sort of exotically terrible it seems. From a distance, it seems like you could never meet people living in urban slums who are smart, motivated, nice, friendly. But you do. And so although it's a world with terrible problems, it doesn't feel as totally bleak when you get to know it better.
Well, Nicholas Lemon, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Nicholas Lemon is a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine and author of the new book, The Promised Land, The Great Black Migration and How It Changed America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.